I don't know if you want to do like a roll call to see if everybody that
No.
wants to be on is on or just
Hold
roll.
on, I don't know how many people can talk this range, but it's great.
Okay.
So I'm going to call the council meeting to order of August 22nd, 2024. I guess this is my first shared meeting, so I'll definitely mess things up.
Thank
but anyway,
you.
Let's start with the standing for the Pledge of Allegiance. My pledge of allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, the two republic, which stands on a nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. So tonight we're going to be talking about preservation outside of the historic district, some in its various ways, shapes, and forms. But the first thing I'd like to do is ask if there are any public comments before we launch into tonight's subject. All right, hearing none, there'll be another opportunity for public comment after presentation and discussion amongst council and our committee members. So thank you guys for joining council this evening. We have the Planning Commission, Historic Architectural Review Board, and Joint Historic Commission represented here tonight. All of them have been invited to join us because all of them have been focusing on this subject as it relates to their work on their committees. So thank you all for coming. And your thoughts, ideas, and opinions are going to be very helpful to us on council. And we look forward to continuing to discuss you tonight and as we move forward. So let me start by saying this. There are many tools available, and that's what really we're going to be talking about in terms of tools available that will aid us in our efforts to preserve or manage outside of the district. But we should also keep in mind that ultimately we're going to have to focus on what our goals are, because tools are one thing, but probably the harder thing is going to be to decide what we want to do as a community in these unique areas that are outside of the historic district. A little background for anyone who's not familiar with it. I know all our committee members are, but if anyone's listening. So the historic district, I believe, was established really in the 70s. Is that about right?
I think like 70s and then expanded.
So almost 50 years. And it's done a really good job of helping us preserve our architectural heritage here at the borough. It's a cumbersome process. It adds work for anyone in the historic district that wants to apply for renovations or additions, but you can't argue with the results. It avoids remodeling, it controls demolition of historic structures, and it preserves. And that's, I don't want to say the only thing, but that's a significant part of what makes Newtown enjoyable, attractive, desirable place to live, and also results in the kind of property values that we're experiencing. So a little bit of pain in going through the process has resulted in a preservation not only of individual homes, but the district as a whole, and it contributes to the fabric of our community. Loosely, there are probably, I could describe it as four areas outside the historic district. There's Washington Village area that we're all familiar with, going up the hill towards the school. There is the Edgeboro area, and really that's an area that's been under discussion a lot because we've seen some tear downs and some rather large new homes replacing small homes. There is the area, really the kind of the east, directly to the east of the historic district, which is an older, but a mix of architectural styles. In other words, between the historic district and the cemetery, so to speak, a mix of the styles and mixed sizes, and really an interesting area in that regard. And then finally, on the southeast side where John resides, we also have more of a late 20th century suburban feel to that area. So we don't have one area outside. Each one of them has some interesting characteristics to it. So what do we want to do in terms of preserving? Are we interested in addressing scale and density? Are we interested in just identifying the most important historic structures for preservation? Are we interested in trying to maintain a feel more comprehensively? It's ultimately going to be a difficult discussion, but tonight we're going to start with what the tools are. And so I'm going to introduce Megan McNish. I have her bio right here somewhere. There it is. Megan McNish is the Eastern Regional Community Preservation Coordinator for the Pennsylvania State Historic Preservation Office, which is a bureau of the Pennsylvania Historical and Museum Commission. So you focus on the eastern half of the state. As the Eastern Region's Community Preservation Coordinator, she provides technical assistance to certified local governments such as ours and community preservation partners. Prior to joining SHPO, Megan was a historic preservation planner for the city of Columbia, South Carolina, where she reviewed preservation projects at the local level. And she's a graduate of Gettysburg College, where she received her bachelor's degree in history, and also West Virginia University, where she received her master's degree in public history. Megan is passionate about helping communities find ways to preserve their historic places. So I think with that, I'll hand over the evening, or at least the main part of the evening, to you, Megan. Megan has a presentation ready for us, and we'll have at it. If there are, key questions, it's okay to interrupt, but let's try to keep it going as much as possible. There'll be lots of time for a discussion at the end. And finally, we'll try to keep it to about an hour and a half. That's the goal.
Thank you all for having me this evening. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and to talk broadly about community planning and preservation planning, what the heck all this means, what tools there are available to you as a borough to protect places that you care about. So this evening we'll talk preservation-specific community planning approaches, and then community planning approaches that can result in preservation but aren't necessarily included in traditional preservation methodology. Ultimately, I think there are a few things that I want us to kind of keep at the core of our discussion. One of them is that planning and preservation planning is really about managing change over time. It's not about freezing our community as it is today. The fact that nothing's ever going to change, that's certainly not the goal. We want to manage how that change happens, when, where. I also want to emphasize, I'm going to be speaking sort of broadly in kind of general terms, not really specifically about Newtown, but about the tools that are generally available to communities. So there are going to be a couple of instances where I talk about possibilities, but I don't want to make that seem like it's a prescription. It's not. Ultimately, you know what's best for your community. You're going to be able to determine what your goals are and what's going to fit best within those goals. Our conversation tonight is really about how you can make those goals a reality. So come to some of that kind of conversation and consensus about community goals. Like Chris said, we're going to be doing some brainstorming and Q&A at the end. I do have to caveat this presentation with the fact that I'm not a lawyer, so I can't provide legal advice. So nothing in this conversation is intended to be that. You should always talk to your municipal solicitor about any changes to your ordinance or regulation. So with that, I also want to touch quickly on our state constitution. Article 1, Section 27 says that people have a right to clean air, pure water, and the preservation of the natural, scenic, historic, and aesthetic values of the environment. So that's really the foundation for communities in Pennsylvania to be able to regulate historic places. That is enabled by our legislature through two pieces of statewide enabling legislation. So we're now moving into our preservation-specific community planning approaches. The first you're all very familiar with, because you already have a historic district through the Historic District Act here in Newtown. The Historic District Act is sometimes also known as Act 167. And then we also have the Municipalities Planning Code. I don't want to spend too much time on the Historic District Act because I think you're all probably pretty familiar with that. But I think there are slightly two possibilities, again, broadly speaking, under the Historic District Act. The first is to create a new historic district or multiple historic districts to address the areas that Chris mentioned, or to expand the current district. I know a little bit about Newtown's historic district, not as much as I would want to be able to make really solid recommendations, but what I do know is that the period of significance ends in the early 20th century, but a lot of the places that we're talking about, the community, neighborhoods that we're talking about in this context are later 20th century. So if you were to expand the district, that would mean extending the period of significance. Well, such as something to kind of keep in the back of your minds. So is the Historic District Act the right approach? And I'm going to have, if you're following along on the printout, I'll have slides like this come up as we talk about each of these potential options. And these are questions that I want you to consider as you, develop your community goals and think, more in depth about the opportunities that are available. So the first question I think it's important to ask is expansion of the historic district feasible? Is there a historic fabric in those areas that connects? Is there a story there? Is that expansion really gonna hold together? Are there enough historic resources in a particular concentration that make expansion make sense? Or are there a lot of buildings that would be considered non-contributing, that would have been built outside of the period of significance or so drastically altered, that is going to determine whether an expansion holds together. And the district has been expanded in the past. It was expanded in 1985, so that's a process the borough has gone through already. So looking back at those records could be informative too in terms of what the thought was, back in 1985 versus the challenges that you're facing today. The next question that I think is probably even more important in some respects is, do the existing hard regulations address the borough's goals? If you're going to expand the historic district, are you really looking for traditional preservation outcomes, or is the goal something else? It's okay if traditional preservation is not the goal. I'm not here to sell you on preservation. I know I have community preservation coordinator in my title, but if it doesn't make sense in terms of the borough's goals to make preservation the mechanism, then it doesn't make sense. I'm here to tell you what makes the most sense for your community. One other thing to mention too, and this is, I think, real positive, is the HARB's long track record. There's an understanding of what that process is, what it entails. That track record, that understanding what the expectation is, can be a real comfort to folks as change happens. It's not scary, it's not new, it's just
exciting. Start off by saying, hey, can everybody at least manage their interruptions? So now I'm the first to interrupt. So you mentioned contributing versus non-contributing. I'm not that familiar with what that means. I don't, maybe everybody else is, but maybe you could just touch on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So contributing and non-contributing buildings are There are both in historic districts. Contributing buildings are those that are built within the period of significance and that retain integrity to that period. So they look like they did, not necessarily when they were built, but during the period for which the district is significant. So again, ending in the early 20th century. Non-contributing buildings are those that are built outside of the period of significance or have been so drastically altered that you can't tell that they're a historic building anymore. So when we create historic districts, we want to see that there's a majority of contributing buildings versus non-contributing buildings in a district. So, for example, if you have a group of 10 buildings that are going to be a historic district, you want 5 or 6 of them to be, contributing buildings, and then, 4, maybe 5, if you're really squeaking by, can be not contributing. Buildings that are non-contributing are not, don't get a free pass in a historic district, because again, our goal is to manage change over time to ensure that there's some level of consistency within a historic district. So generally speaking, non-contributing buildings have a little bit more latitude, but they don't get a free pass. So that's kind of the differentiation. So anybody?
Just a clarifying question. Mm-hmm. So for our historic district, including the expansion in 1985,
mm-hmm.
what is considered to be the contributing period?
So the period of significance from the documentation that I read is, I think, sometime in the early 19th century through the early 20th century, but I'd have to double check.
So the early 1900s is sort of the end of the period of significance?
Yes, correct.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
And the documentation wasn't terribly specific about what early 20th century means. I would say, again, in general sort of historical parlance, I would say early 20th century is like 1920-ish. But I would say 1920-ish would be the kind of general, but not knowing all of the buildings in your district, I can't really give you a better estimation than that.
I recall that there was the number that's always gets thrown around is that at the time the district was established, that the majority of the buildings were at least 50 years old. And so we're well past 50 years from when that happened.
Yes.
So it's, there might be buildings that now would be that 50-year-old.
Yes. And I will also say that the methodology and the way that we certify historic districts has evolved. As you may or may not know, PHMC certifies local historic districts created through the Historic District Act. And as a result of that, we take in documentation and we send it to the formal commission that's appointed by the governor's office. And they put a big rubber stamp on it and they say certified. But with that, we prepare documentation in concert with our local partners to demonstrate the significance of the district. And again, that process, how much documentation, what kinds of information has evolved over time. So now we would more firmly nail down that period, but in 1985, when the district was expanded, it's a little bit more fluid.
So quick question.
Yes.
Does that mean that 50 years is a sliding scale?
We're
at 1935. We were 85. It's 1935 is the end of our significance. Or is it sliding 50 years?
Well, it stopped at that point when the district was created, right? It's 50 years before that.
I'm an attorney. This is not legal advice. I would say, in terms of the regulation, it would be that 50-year mark from that time.
1935.
Now, our scale obviously evolves year by year. We look at 50 years from, you know, this year when we're evaluating properties and districts for either local designation or national register designation. So it's a yes to both, depending on the context. But that's preservation.
Thank you.
No problem. So the next piece of enabling legislation that I want to spend a little bit more time on is the municipalities planning code. The MPC is really the foundation for zoning in our community, period. But it also enables communities to create special zoning ordinances and districts for historic properties and either enact benefits and or restrictions on those properties. The MPC differs from the Historic District Act and then it allows for the designation of individual properties as well as providing special consideration for historic preservation when reviewing variances, subdivision applications, and special exceptions. Like I said earlier, there are opportunities to create incentives for historic properties through the MPC, which can be really useful and be a great tool. So traditionally in the preservation model, the MPC focuses on sort of scattered site designation when communities don't have a concentration of historic resources in a particular area. They'll often use the MPC as their mechanism to protect and regulate historic properties. But the opportunity to provide incentives for preservation is something that communities use in concert with the Historic District Act and other regulatory tools. It doesn't have to be used only when the MPC is used for other or for designation alone. So incentives for preservation of buildings which meet community developed significance criteria could be allowing for an accessory dwelling unit, variances to parking requirements, additional allowable uses like bed and breakfasts or shops, small scale eateries, you know, things that are compatible with where your historic resources are typically found, or additional lot coverage. Kennett Township has an ordinance that relies pretty heavily on preservation incentives. There is regulation in that ordinance as well, but a lot of their ordinance is about encouraging preservation rather than requiring it. Like I said, preservation incentives through the MPC can be overlaid on top of a historic district. So it's not a one or, you know, one or the other proposition. It's something, you know, you can use as a tool together.
That's good. For this purpose, what is it? Historic property to overlap with this particular?
That is a great question. It can just be over the historic district, or, you know, you can work as a community to come up with your own criteria for what is significant, things that would be outside of the historic district. You know, I think Kennett Townships has some of that framework for determining, you know, what properties would meet the significance criteria to be able to take advantage of the incentives. But they can be the same or they can be different. It's very flexible is really the name of the game with the MPC. There's a lot of flexibility inherently built into the enabling legislation. But that's a great question. Any others before I keep rattling?
Just one quick question. I mean, we're looking at trying to expand the historic district. And we come up with criteria that we feel justify those properties. And then we establish the ordinance and then take it to the, to the MPC for the rubber stamp, or can we get guidance in the meantime, say, well, no, this isn't gonna be acceptable, or is that just more or less for us to determine?
So if you opt to pursue expansion of the Historic District through the Historic District Act, then certainly, you know, that's something I could continue to provide assistance with. Really most of the approaches that we'll talk about, I can certainly continue continue to assist, in developing or determining, community goals, kind of guiding discussion, things like that. But yes, it would eventually go to the Historical and Museum Commission for certification, and that's a formal process, but that's after you've adopted the ordinance.
And how many, how many applications are denied? Just to get a, is it a common thing, or after you go through all that? I'm looking at just going through all the work and then finding out that, it's not acceptable. And I think, that's something that we would want to try to avoid. Because it takes time.
So we don't get too many of these applications. I think our last one was in 2019, so it's been some time since that sort of district come through. But there is a staff recommendation section. So the hope is that by the time you get to the point where you're submitting for commission review, the staff recommendation says, yes, please certify this. And that there are no hiccups at the commission level. So I wouldn't worry too terribly much at this stage that a district application would be denied. I think that's something that would come up much sooner in the process than getting to the application phase.
Hey, Judy, as we interrupt, don't need names. Do you know what about you so far?
Yeah.
Okay. And you want to just say, who are you, or should I ask people to?
No, I'm not sure.
Okay.
Do you have a question? Yeah. So, in order to expand the historic district, do the majority of the homes within the designated expansion area have to be classified as contributing?
Yes. Yes.
Good question.
And just one, still within the historic district, adding, is there a repository list somewhere for those communities, first of those communities that have historic districts in place, and secondly, for those that do, how they define their periods of significance? Is there something we can use as a point of reference in this process to say, the majority of communities that did this looked at it this way?
Yeah, I think there's probably not that level of consistency between communities. I think, folks have come at this desire to protect historic places in a variety of ways. But there is a repository where all of this information lives. That's PA Share. It's our online data management tool. And you can go into PA Share and search for locally listed historic districts. And I can give you my card at the end. If you send me an email, I can shoot you instructions on how to search for that. So it's a little bit easier, or I can share it with you, Chris, and you can disseminate it. So that'll make it a little bit easier, but I can also, our most recent historic district that was designated was Narberth Borough, and I'm happy to share the staff report for that as well, so you can see, what that included.
Any other questions? Well, instinctively, just knowing the neighborhoods, I'm concluding that we do not have a majority of contributing buildings in the areas to which we want to speak. Would that be enough? Yeah.
Go ahead. I was going to say I would disagree. Go ahead.
Well, maybe your areas of expansion are different than the ones that we've talked about, but in any event, I presume there are other tools?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, like I said, the MPC is a totally different piece of enabling legislation. We just talked about scattered sites as kind of the primary mechanism, but also preservation incentives is another that's available through the MPC. There is a third called conservation zoning districts. These are similar to a historic district, but in general, they take a sort of lighter hand in their regulation than traditional historic districts do. Pottstown Borough has a variety Yes.
You talked a little bit about incentives. You mentioned incentives. If you, what type of incentive would be offered, I suppose?
Yeah. So the mechanism that's available for the MPC is zoning incentives. So things like allowing for an accessory dwelling unit in a base zoning district that you might not traditionally allow for, variances to parking requirements, additional allowable uses, additional lot coverage. So they're not financial incentives in terms of dollars and cents, but they can make preservation a more enticing option. For example, I know from my time as a local preservation planner that the accessory dwelling unit has become a very, very hot topic in the planning world. There's a lot of interest in accessory dwelling units. That can be a really desirable opportunity for folks. So in a preservation incentive scenario, if a property owner were to preserve their home, their historic building, they would then be allowed to add some kind of accessory dwelling unit to their property through that incentive. Now, what exactly that looks like is, part of the conversation down the road, right? How big is that building? Where should it be located on the lot? Does the property owner have to live at the property in order to take advantage of that option for an accessory dwelling unit? So there are a lot of other questions to ask down the line. And the incentives that I mentioned are not the only ones available, through zoning. There are a whole host of different things that you can do, but those are just some of the more popular or hot topics that can come up. Any other questions?
So this one, so this would be a bring us in on a house or a building that would not be in the historic district, but wants to do some type of work. So is the condition to doing that type of work, like the accessory, they would then become part of, they would agree to become part of the historic district?
No, so this is operating totally independently of the historic district.
Okay.
It is its own independent thing. It's a zoning overlay, so it doesn't change fundamentally what a property owner can do on their lot. For example, your lot coverage is 40%. It doesn't mean that you necessarily get additional lot coverage if you conform to preservation. It just means that you can, have this benefit of an accessory dwelling unit.
But you could make it more. I bet you can make a bigger addition or more lot coverage with your with your patio or whatever you got, outdoor things. But there's pretty much anything that's in our zoning code. You can make a little laundry list of benefits for those people if their house qualifies as a historic structure and if they want to agree to preserve in exchange for having those access. So it'll be written into the zoning code and then they don't have to negotiate, it's just there if they're willing to do that.
Other questions? So conservation zoning districts are very similar to traditional historic districts. But again, this would be independent of your existing historic district. It's not an expansion. It's something independent and on its own. And like I said, generally, these districts are a little bit lighter in terms of how they regulate properties within their boundaries. And Pottstown Borough has a few different types of conservation zoning districts that I think are interesting to take a look at. They have a residential conservation zoning district, a town neighborhood, and then a downtown one as well. They look at larger scale, sort of broader stroke changes, things like demolition of buildings larger than 500 square feet, additions greater than 200 square feet, and the size, height, design, and location of new buildings on a lot. So it functions very similar to a traditional historic district, but it's independent of the existing historic district. So it can allow the borough to develop regulations that help implement community goals that may not align with the regulation that exists within the boundaries of the current historic district.
And there's no qualifications to do conservation district, like a contributing village. There's nothing like that.
So part of the look at contributing and not contributing buildings in the Historic District Act is because they have to be certified by the Pennsylvania Historical and Museum Commission. With the NPC, you can do this independent of us, basically. There's no oversight from the HFC on this. So it's about how the community defines, what constitutes a conservation
zone. And what's the difference between overlay district and conservation?
It is also an overlay district.
And so does a conservation district regulate more like forms, like size, as opposed to materials? Like the historic district, you're talking about materials and kind of preserving and replacement methods. But that this would be looking more like, don't build a huge house, can you surround it by little houses?
Generally speaking, yes. It's more about those broad, large-scale changes. It's about changes to details or materials. So you're looking at that, you don't want to have that house that's five times the size of all the houses around it. That's sort of the underlying premise.
Any other questions about that?
Yeah, but that would only apply to homes that would qualify, right? So if we were, can you hear me?
Yeah,
so if we were talking about homes that were, attractive homes that, were all, let's say 1500 square feet or something, and somebody wanted to tear one down to build a super large home, but it doesn't qualify for the historic aspect, then we would have no way of controlling that, correct?
So you would still review anything new that would go back on the lot, and you're looking at things like size, scale, placement on the lot. So you would still have some oversight for anything that's within that zoning overlay district.
Okay, so the demolition and reconstruction would not be limited, but we would have more control over what could be put back.
It could be limited. Ultimately, a lot of this depends on how you construct this conservation zoning district. Like I said earlier, the MPC is extremely flexible in what it allows communities to do. It's ultimately about allowing communities to manage themselves and manage change within their confines over time. So there are a lot of different ways that you can choose to regulate things, and how you construct that regulation is going to dictate how that plays out. Again, the conservation zoning district is sort of the concept. The implementation is really about how the community defines the regulation.
I think we all have a lot more to learn about the conservation district concept. Lily Levy introduced it.
Mm-hmm.
We're all probably scratching our heads a little bit.
Yeah.
Let me ask just one more question about it, though. Mm-hmm. Who qualifies, if it's not being qualified mm-hmm. by the state, who's mm-hmm. qualifying the structures under a conservation district?
So you develop your criteria, or you could even go with just a simple 50 years of age or older, guideline or rule. It really depends. It's ultimately the community.
It sounds very flexible.
It is. Yeah, it is. And I think in general, if you take nothing away, take one thing away from this presentation, the MPC is extremely flexible in what it allows communities to do. There are a lot of different types of regulation that exist in Pennsylvania under the MPC. Some of them are good, some of them are not good. Some of them work really, really well for the communities that they exist in. Others don't work well at all. I think the biggest takeaway is defining your community goals clearly is going to help you create the best response to those goals. So these are some of the tools, but there's a lot of different ways you can define those tools. Any other questions? I know this is a lot to take in too. That's why I created a presentation so you have a little bit of something to wrap up with.
Does any of this differentiate between residential and commercial use?
It can. I would take a look at Pottstown as an example. They have both residential and commercial conservation zoning districts. So I don't think there's a whole lot of difference in what they regulate, but how it's regulated is obviously going to be different between commercial and residential.
For Pottstown as an example, who administers the conservation overlay? Does it go to a farm? Is it just the building inspector? Is it the zoning officer?
I believe they have a preservation or some kind of review board that reviews all of their projects. They also have historic districts through the Historic District Act, and they have a HARB. So I'm not sure if their HARB reviews this as well. The HARB can be the designated review body for something like this, but I'm just not sure in this case. Yes.
Any other questions?
There will be.
It's complicated. It's really complicated. So the last topic I want to touch on under the MPC, and if you can believe it, we're still on the MPC, that's just how flexible it is aligning base zoning with your community goals. So I did a little bit of research, and it looks like, and correct me if I'm wrong, the last time that Newtown's zoning ordinance was overhauled was 2004. It's hard to believe that that's 20 years ago. I can't really wrap my mind around that. But the challenges that existed 20 years ago were likely very different than they are now. So this might be an opportunity to take a look at that base zoning to see if it's really supporting your long-term community goals. So to kind of clarify what I mean, if in an area you have large lots with relatively modest homes, but the base zoning allows for much smaller lots than exist in that area and much larger homes than exist in that area, but you want to maintain those large lots, modest homes, the base zoning and what exists currently and what you're trying to encourage in the future really don't align. So ensuring that base zoning is aligned with those long-term goals can help kind of guide folks in that direction. As another example, if you align your base zoning so that larger lots with relatively limited lot coverage are, the norm in that area and that's sort of the pattern of development, you're less likely to see a request for demolition of that building if you can only add another, say, 500 square feet beyond what exists there currently. Maybe someone just adds that addition and calls it a day. Now, it's not guaranteed that that's going to be the outcome. Someone may say, I want a new house, I'm going to come in, I'm going to bulldoze this one, and we're going to start fresh. But by aligning the underlying zoning, you can encourage certain outcomes that can include preservation, but it doesn't require that people preserve properties. They can still demolish a building with the traditional process that you follow now, but it just means that it's less attractive to do so. Any questions on that? So we finally reached the end of our conversation about the MPC, and like I said, it is so flexible. what you could do under the MPC. There's a lot of opportunity, to again achieve that goal that the MPC sets out to promote the health and general welfare of our communities. So there's scattered site preservation, preservation incentives, conservation zoning districts, overlays, and those base zoning provisions, aligning those with your community goals. So now we're really shifting gears into some other community planning tools that exist that are definitely not in the traditional preservation arsenal, but can certainly result in preservation outcomes. I will be fully upfront with you. These are things that I don't work with terribly frequently. They're sort of on the periphery of preservation, but I wanted to just briefly have a conversation about them. So you can evaluate whether these are approaches that make sense in your community context. It's also, as a caveat, these are, I would say, more of an intervention in terms of their approach. They'll really change how the borough does business, and that, may be a drawback. But again, I think it's important to fully evaluate the opportunities that are available to you. So the first one I want to touch on is form-based code. Form-based code is a land development regulation which fosters predictable built results in a high-quality public realm by using physical form rather than the separation of uses as the organizing principle for the code. It's a regulation, it's not a guideline, and it's an alternative to traditional zoning. The focus in general in form-based code is on form over function, and it's a relatively recent development in the planning world. It really came onto the scene in the early 2000s and didn't really start to get implemented widely until the 2010s. Narberth Borough that I mentioned earlier uses form-based code in addition to their local historic district, and they also have an overlay for preservation incentives. So they're an interesting example, I think, to take a look at. Another borough, they have gone through this process relatively recently, like I said, 2018, 2019. And again, this is sort of the foundation that they rely on. Form-based code really looks at the relationship between buildings and the public realm, form and massing in relationship between buildings, and the scale of streets and blocks. So it's less prescriptive in terms of what can go in certain places. It's about connecting complementary uses into certain areas. So a form-based code includes five main elements: a regulating plan, which tells you where different building forms and standards apply; public standards, which are more about streetscapes and sidewalks and street trees, street parking; building standards, which control the features, configuration, and function of buildings; administration, which is the application and review process; and definitions. Also add additional regulation to form-based code beyond those five sort of main elements, including architectural regulation, landscape, environmental resource regulation, and sign standards. There is a lot of information on formbasedcodes.org. It's a nonprofit organization that promotes form-based code as a planning tool. They can tell you a whole lot more about this. There's a lot of nuance to it, but it's something that exists. Now, is form-based code the right approach? Again, this is something that would require pretty significant intervention, time and investment to implement. So it's not something you can necessarily, turn around particularly quickly. It takes time to create that kind of regulation. It does create a strong community-wide design ethic with clear expectations, which can be a really great tool. But again, it is a pretty large-scale intervention.
I'll just offer one comment because I've run into form-based code in negotiating rezoning communities, and it's usually associated with new development. Not always, but usually, and it can be so the community is interested in new development, but they want it to be like neo-traditional, right? So they want to make sure it doesn't look, it looks more like a town center or whatever it is that they want it to look like. They basically write a book of standards in terms of how far you can be from the street to, depending upon each other building, how tall, what materials, what the drip line's going to look like, what the roof's going to look like. It can be it can be actually extremely prescriptive, almost down to individual locations, or it can be a more general guideline. But it is it's a book that really creates a relatively limited palette in which an architect can design a particular building.
Yeah, and that's part of how it can support or encourage folks to retain historic buildings is that you're not getting anything particularly different than what you had often before if you demolish a building. But again, it is definitely much more of an intense sort of scrutiny than I think a lot of the other options we've discussed. Any questions about that? So the next option that I wanted to just cover briefly is traditional neighborhood development. Again, this is a much more intense intervention than some of the others that we've discussed, but it's the development strategy that's designed to create complete neighborhoods that mimic those that were built pre-1950. In general, TMDs are characterized by concentrated density, mixed housing types, interconnected street grids, and a defined town center. This tool is most often used for new development, but it can be applied to a community at large. And you know, your existing town center is the town center, and you build the regulation out from there. Based on what Chris has told me and Craig has told me about some of the conversations that have been happening at the community level, this doesn't seem like the squarest fit. It's kind of like a square peg in a round hole.
We have two TND ordinances.
Yeah.
And one is residential and one is mixed use. So it's not gonna it works if you have that big piece of property.
And where it can work in support of preservation is, because it promotes density, you can guide that to certain areas over others. But ultimately, many of the benefits that a TMD provide can be accomplished in other ways. There are other tools that exist outside of TMDs that can really do change. But again, I think it's worth taking a look at, even if it's very quickly dismissed. Sometimes we look at things and say, that's not right for our community, we move on, and that's totally okay. Any questions?
Well, I guess the only thing I could say is that we do have a TND in Newtown that was for a larger development of a larger tract of land. So we have some experience with that. But it is primarily used for, you think, bigger tracts of land, though, that would be the...
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So just to quickly review what we've covered, and then we'll shift into some discussion. We talked about the Historic District Act, potentially expanding the existing historic district or creating new historic districts to cover the areas that are of concern. We talked about the NPC, the Municipalities Planning Code, using that for a traditional preservation application with scattered site preservation or preservation incentives. We talked about using the MPC for conservation district overlays. We talked about the MPC and underlying zoning and aligning that with community goals. And then most recently, form-based code and traditional neighborhood development. So from there, because I don't know if you want to tag team this or you want me to take the lead. Okay. So I just wanted to offer some questions for discussion to think about. Ultimately, like I said at the beginning, defining your community goals is really going to help figure out which of these approaches is going to be the best fit, and how to make that approach fit your needs. So there was a lot of conversation when Craig and I were talking about demolition and, you know, removal of, I'll just say, older and historic homes. How big of a concern is that? Is it the buildings specifically that were lost, or is it what went back in place of those buildings?
Are you asking quantitatively or qualitatively? Quantitatively, depending on how you look at it outside the historic district, there are either 7 or 8 examples of this in the last 10 years in 334 months. So it's a tiny percentage of loss in the borough outside the historic district. Qualitatively, and again, it seems like it's managing in the corner case. I found data on 4 of the 7 homes that were built in their place. They were between 3,000 and 3,500 square feet. The other 3, I don't have data, but I'm pretty sure they're larger than that. As a point of reference, an historic home on North Chancellor Street is 6,000 square feet. A historic home at the corner of Washington and Lincoln is 4,000 square feet. So again, there seems like there are probably 3 or 4 homes at issue from a size standpoint. But in terms of the number of occurrences of this, it's relatively small. Now, I know people will have a different point of view. One is more than enough, but it's not an everyday occurrence.
I think what my concern is that it's changing these homes that are being demolished and replaced in a scale that's disproportionate to the homes that are in that neighborhood. And it's changing the fabric of the neighborhood. I would hate to be that little rancher that now has this monstrous house next to it, right? But to me, that's got to, our current zoning lets that happen, right? Because it's all about the pervious surface ratio and height and everything else. So in my mind, it's changing the zoning.
Well, I hate to be the rancher next door unless I have an interest in selling my home as the rancher next door.
So I see a couple issues with that. Well, first of all, is that first time we started seeing the mansion explosion was right after the stormwater management was first passed in the Chamonix watershed, which then required if you were to expand your home that you had, you know, had to do things on your site. Mm-hmm. So immediately after that, instead of houses going out, they went up. Mm-hmm. And that's when we saw that first bunch of really big houses appear on Edgefoot Drive. They wanted to get a bigger house and they didn't want to go out. They went up, so they didn't have to do any of the stormwater stuff. Over time, I've been here a long time, that what's happening now is that Newtown's a very desirable place to live, but it seems like people are coming in and purchasing homes with the intent of demolishing them and building a larger home on the lot.
Yeah.
And what we're losing in that whole thing is the variety of housing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're losing the little houses. Some of the houses that are right outside the historic district that are really at risk are at the east end, like that there are a couple of Sears Roebuck houses that aren't in the, they're not in the historic district. So, and a number of years ago, I was on a committee where we were looking at expanding the historic district in the direction towards the cemetery, you know, not going as far as the, you know, Edgefoot Drive area and Washington Village, not going into those newer neighborhoods. But there are still older neighborhoods that might not have quite qualified for, but are adjacent to the historic district now. And we got pretty far, and then unfortunately the committee kind of lost steam and we didn't get passed. But the problem was, you know, we wanted to make sure that we weren't losing these smaller historic houses thing will become huge. And I think that's one of the things that really bothers me. And I think that, oh, yes, there haven't been that many if you count them up, but it seems like it's increasing exponentially. And I think that's what made people suddenly say, look, what's going on here?
And I keep coming back to Marburg, but I think they grappled with many of the same issues of, you know, wanting to maintain a diverse housing stock that, you know, was accessible to a variety of people and not shifting to, you know, to houses of monolithic size that were, you know, totally and completely unaffordable. They wanted to maintain that diversity that existed in the housing stock in their community. So I think it's a useful comparison to look at.
I think as a corollary to demolition, we haven't, you know, we've been having, unfortunately, recently, more and more of our older buildings, you know, some have been damaged, some have been, you know, they were going to be refurbished. And we've always, I'm on HARB, and we've always tried to have them, you know, maintain the defining characteristics of the building. And based on that, it's not really, you know, I guess our definition of replacement is in kind is to replace it exactly as it is. And what we've been finding is that we get to a point and then suddenly we find out that no, it's not being replaced exactly it is. Some of it is relatively the same. Some of it isn't, you know, has no bearing on what it initially was. I guess this is a problem that, you know, really has to be addressed by council, but do you have any other, you know, do you have ordinances or other communities that you've had, you've talked with this situation?
Yeah, I think in a lot of respects, that's a separate issue from what we're talking about this evening. You know, certainly that seems like an implementation thing to me, but I think that's probably a future conversation. You know, is looking at the
HARB
regulations.
And Bob, we can take that up with the solicitor. In kind, probably has brackets on it legally in terms of what it is and what it isn't, whether that's statutory or by whether it's been duped out in the courts, not that everybody knows what it is. I don't know, but we'll look into that. It's a good point.
I have a question, Craig Deutsch. I have a question, and I think Bob was touching on a concept of we deal with often demolition by neglect.
Mm-hmm.
That someone owns these properties, they're there, they don't maintain them properly, and then they come in and say, wait, I can't really do that, or it's cost prohibitive. And I believe that historic nature does not really consider cost as an issue. That really has to do with how we set our parameters. What I really want to touch on is if we're talking about demolition by neglect and we start with an overlay or expanding the historic district or this ability to have a conversation before something just gets knocked down or so on and so forth, the enforcement rules behind the demolition with neglect, how have you seen that been applied? Is it a tax basis? Do people get fines? Are there liens placed on the property? Any good rule needs good enforcement. If you don't have good enforcement, there's no good rules.
I think demolition by neglect is also similarly a different issue than you know, talking about preservation tools. That really gets into the details of your ordinance and what your demolition by neglect, regulation looks like, if you have it. Similarly,
well, have you know of or have you seen examples of such an ordinance?
Yeah, there are, you know, a variety of approaches to demolition by neglect, but that is something that should be included in your existing historic district ordinance along with economic hardship provisions. You know, by defining clearly what constitutes an economic hardship, and often those provisions clearly articulate that hardships can't be self-created by a property owner, because the hardship is with the property, it's not with the owner. So by including both economic hardship and demolition by neglect provisions, you can begin to address that issue. It's certainly an enforcement issue as well. There needs to be a mechanism to enforce that, but creating the foundation so that you have something in your ordinance that addresses it is really the first step. But I can certainly find some examples and share those as well.
Thank you. That'd be great.
One of the things that you touched on was that defining the community goals clearly was really the most important aspect of this, and being able to develop and being able to choose the right tool set for addressing this problem. How do you see that being done across communities? Is it done based on, the elected officials and their conversations with neighbors in the community? Is it more of an official, community polling type thing, or is it, kind of a mix of that and maybe, town hall type stuff?
I would generally recommend sort of sessions like this, but ones that are accessible to the community at large. People can have their voice heard. I think like any planning process, you can't incorporate every suggestion and every opinion that exists, but if you can start to find where there's consensus, with that sort of broad community outreach, I think that's probably the best path forward. Now, how exactly you do that also depends on how you already have connection with the community at large. Do you have a newsletter, township newsletter that goes out on a regular basis that, something like that could be advertised or questions could be asked? Do you have an email list? How do you connect with your community? Tapping into those existing channels is really helpful. And again, you know that much better than I do. Using those tools to connect to the community at large.
What's next?
So next is the specific areas that Chris mentioned early on. Is there interest in all of these areas and what's happening in those neighborhoods, or is there just a few of them, one of them, all of them, some of them, none of them?
I think that depends upon the community goals that we develop.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I'd be curious to know if at least you all, I just kind of made that up, right? But it sort of felt like those four areas have a little bit of a different personality. They're all newer, right, than the historic district, but they all have a little bit of different personality. And so I thought it's not necessary to think of them as four different ones, but I just thought I would mention that they have that.
What's the four?
Okay, so we've got the Edgeboro area.
Edgewood Frost, Edgeboro Frost,
yeah.
Washington Village, Southeast, as well as Slide Sets.
Edgeboro Frost. Then the second one will be Washington Village. The third one, I didn't know how to define it by streets.
Is that like Lafayette?
Colonial
Village.
And the fourth then is a piece in the middle. It's kind of got a little bit of everything between here and between the edge of the historic district east to the edge of town.
Okay, thanks.
Interestingly, there are little pieces along our historic district that we had looked at before. So the historic district ends on this side of Jefferson. So the other side of Jefferson, there are these little pieces that are hanging out there, or like along next to Pickering Field when you go up Chancellor Street. Like once you get past Jefferson, the first house after that.
Like Federal Lane's not.
Federal Lane's not in, and that's newer. But there are older homes on Chancellor Street, but the only one that's in the historic district is the corner house. So, it's as you go up that block, go up the 200 block towards the township, that's not in the historic
district. Leaving that little summit, is it summit that goes to Washington Village? Like that one little street?
That's
is
not even in the
borough. Oh, that's township.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So, yeah, but there's all this, this is kind of a ring around the existing historic district that is ripe for preservation. And then when you go beyond that, then suddenly you get to the new developments that historically, you know, with the farms all around us, then got, you know, the 60s that they got built up around us. But there's still that ring. And that's what we had kind of looked at before about the expanding out.
In that you talked about a variety of approaches. There might not be one that addresses, you know, concerns for all areas of the borough that are not within the historic district. It's possible that expanding to those areas that you mentioned, you know, is one step. And then there's another, you know, option for a different, you know, an area beyond that that is of concern. So I think I guess I just want to emphasize that it doesn't, you don't have to think, you know, monolithically that there's only, you only have one that you can pick, and that's it. You can pick and choose what most addresses those sort of broad community concerns.
To that end, and this is, it builds a little bit off of the demolition by neglect discussion, but does your group have any experience with these different approaches and the effect that they have on the renewal of housing stock and the upkeep of housing? Because, you know, if you look at the data, no surprise, since there's not land for new building, but, you know, the census data would tell you that census after census, the average age of homes in the borough is going up. Now, you can say that's great from a historic perspective, but there are also a lot of homes in Newtown Borough that are not in great shape. So, if you say, okay, everything is in the historic district, it's all frozen.
Not frozen. Managed.
But I guess, is there any experience in these communities with what impact does it have on renewal of housing stock, upgrading of housing stock, upkeep of housing stock? And how should we think about making sure that that is something that's a part of the picture as we think about different options here?
So we don't necessarily have data that drills all the way down to all of the points you brought up, or, you know, all the way down to the community level in Pennsylvania. But what we see time and time again is that historic districts generally show, you know, higher and more consistent property values over time. You know, with that, I think there's certainly an expectation of maintenance. Whether that happens, I think it probably varies property owner to property owner. You know, that is certainly where something like a demolition by neglect provision can come into play. If a property owner is not maintaining their building and is allowing it to, you know, fall down, that's the mechanism you have. But I think generally speaking, the data nationwide shows that preservation is a good economic development tool locally.
So yes, a couple of things, but that being said, if one of the goals, we have goals before we go anywhere, but if one of the goals is to allow people to come in and have affordable housing, by making things historic, you're automatically increasing the price of the housing.
So it's a little bit more complicated than that.
I'm sure it is, but in
so,
straight out terms, I mean, that's essence is what you're saying, property values go up, right? We saw it happen in the historic business.
Yeah.
We price people out of that.
We also have, I think, historic homes are generally of a diverse size. So you have buildings that are of, you know, you have a 1,500 square foot home, you have a 3,500 square foot home, 6,000 square foot home. Because that diversity exists, there can still be points of affordability. Where we see the value in historic places is that they're maintained over time. Like, for example, in 2008, when the economy, bottomed out, historic properties maintained their values better than properties not in a designated area. That doesn't mean that there weren't affordable designated properties. It just means that their value didn't necessarily plummet.
I think
the
people that were in those homes probably had the financial wherewithal to keep it up, or maybe some did.
Potentially.
The other thing I will say is, being probably the only one in this room and maybe on TV representing those four areas, and everyone here is from the historic district, goals are important because, I've dealt with four houses right around my block being knocked down and built. Some are 10 times better than the previous one, and others are much tougher. This is a disaster, right? So I think if we're going to have conversations, and we said we want the community involved, we really need to get the people impacted by it before we start putting down rules and regulations and what they can do. But your point, someone built a nice house next to mine and my value has just gone up. Why are they telling me that I can't sell it? It's a very tricky and complicated. I do agree that there needs to be some kind of structure around the size of a house that goes in, because some have not been, they don't belong at all. But others, they've done a great job. Three or four of them, even the one next to me that's in the township, that house is 50 times larger than the one that's there before. Was well done. So I think goals are important. And I think communication to the community outside of the people that live in the historic district.
And I think that also, like I said earlier, the options that we talked about, not all of them necessarily require preservation.
Right.
That might not be the right choice, and that's okay if it's not. If it is, great. But yes, you need broader.
Well, and then like the incentives, if you want to do this, if you maintain your home while I'm doing this, I think that's a reasonable approach.
I think that's a really underutilized aspect of the MPC, that option to create incentives for preservation. It offers a lot of variety and a lot of encouragement rather than, additional regulation. There could be some resistance, understandably so, right? Change is always, can always be difficult, but adding incentives is really not adding regulations.
Right. Well, I think to Julia's point earlier, the stormwater issue, right? You can't be building homes that prevent impact that, right? So there's rational reasons behind it. It's not just, we don't want you to change it because we like the way this neighborhood looks.
Yeah.
Right.
So are there more things to talk about there?
I think we kind of covered next steps, really defining your community goals with the community at large. And then from there, as you define what those goals are, evaluating, which of the approaches that we discussed, or maybe there's something out there that I missed, that's always possible, that we'll address.
Just a question relates to goals. In your experience, have communities used any of the tools that you just described to improve housing affordability?
Yes. There are lots and lots of resources out there about affordable housing and preservation and how you can integrate them, and a variety of tools. I can pull together some.
That'd be great. Yeah, because in looking at the issue of housing affordability, a whole bunch of think tanks and elsewhere, none of them have preservation of existing housing as a means of making housing more affordable. Things like multifamily housing, accessory dwelling units, really things that more affect housing density, are the things that make housing more affordable. So I'd love to see some of those resources.
There was a really great study done by the city of San Antonio on, they have a fabulous preservation program, but they looked at areas that are not historically designated, but neighborhoods that are 50 years old or older, and really studied those and how they interplay with affordable housing. So that's one I can think of.
Would love
off
to take
the top of my head.
Yeah, thank you.
Definitely share. But it's certainly a concern, and it's certainly something that you know, you don't want to inadvertently create a situation where you're, you know, pricing folks out. I'm very personally passionate about preservation. It does not mean gentrification. They often go together, but they're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
And gentrification can be a byproduct of the way that we do preservation, not preservation as a philosophy.
So to your point, Ben, is the example that you have a piece of property, instead of having 1,000 foot, two, I guess, four total homes, but smaller, or two twins next to one another, the density would make it lower because then the developer would have more incentive.
Or, yeah, I mean, yeah. The accessory dwelling use is an example. That waterway's been, in the borough.
Right.
There are an awful lot of, buildings that are there that would accommodate, two party person families like that. But, so again, we need to be very clear on what we're trying to accomplish. Because if affordable housing is at the top of the list, there are probably more direct ways to get there than some of what's being described. And maybe not.
How is affordable housing on the top of the list in Newtown?
Oh, that's why I'm asking.
There's nothing that you can do that's going to cap off housing in Newtown. If I'm living next to somebody that has a big barn or something in the back, and you're going to put two units in there that's going to be designated as affordable housing, then what does that do to my property value?
I think affordable housing in the lowercase context, not
right.
The, not so like affordable housing programs, as in. Housing at diverse price points. Housing that's accessible to a diverse group of people, workforce, your teachers and your firefighters and your police officers can afford to live in the borough, as well as, your executives and
accessible housing.
Yes, that's a great way to put it, accessible housing.
It's like the kids who grow up here can't afford to live here.
Yeah. My hometown's the same.
Yeah.
So it happens in a lot of places.
And there were buildings that were multifamily houses and have now turned into single family homes.
Yeah.
That's kind of the trend. And I mean, actually, I was thinking about this too, because our ordinance currently allows you to put an accessory dwelling unit in a garage that hadn't been built. And I can't remember if it's 1975 or 1985, like before that. Well, but that was done. What, 2004? So maybe we need to relook at that. Like, do we say now, okay, it needs to be a building that is X number of years old as opposed to a specific date, and that would create more apartments, because I think we're losing the apartment stock in the borough. That's my sense. I don't know, Ginny, maybe you have a better idea of this, but it seems like there used to be more apartments and they used to be more affordable, but if there is a way to create more of that, then that might help with it.
That, more apartments and we're taking back to single family.
I know.
It's fun to celebrate, right?
Yes.
To celebrate. It's like a great restoration turn to a single family.
Well, some of those actually were originally multifamily homes, so they got turned into
Can you outline from your experience what you've seen in terms of the overall approval process with these preservation-related changes of type? So, is it a process by which, it's discussed it in this and then move to the community, and that feedback is then discussed? And ultimately, where does that then end up, and how does the decision or get made?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think starting broadly at the community level with some larger questions about goals and things like that is a good place to start. From there, I think many communities will choose to create some sort of subcommittee or working group that is tasked with creating that that regulation, or formulating the information that was gathered at the community outreach phase, and whether those folks actually write the regulation, or that's done by a consultant, or a your municipal solicitor. That depends on the community and the resources that exist. But from there, I think once you have a draft of something, that should go back out to the community for public comment, and then it should move through your traditional ordinance adoption process. Whether it goes to planning commission, or you guys know what that looks like.
I was just going to say, during the writing of the comprehensive plan, we had multiple meetings and then sent out a survey monkey.
Mm-hmm.
And we sent it out to the businesses, and we sent it out to the property owners, and kind of used that as feedback to create our input.
And I think thinking of it as a smaller scale version of doing a comprehensive plan is a good way to sort of...
I think it's adorable. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, that's kind of it makes it a little bit more predictable, I think. One other thing I will mention, Chris mentioned early on, you guys are a CLG, a certified local government. You have access to a specific grant program for certified local governments, and certainly creating some kind of preservation regulation is something that would be eligible for a grant. So, if you wanted to bring a consultant on to do some of that work, there is
Julie is great at that.
Available.
It's actually on our September work session.
So if you have questions, I'm your gal. I did want to highlight that, because I know that it can be really intimidating to undertake some of this stuff, to start thinking about these really big questions, and how do we get from big questions to, something on a page. So there, other than me, whatever I'm worth, there is additional assistance available out there beyond just what I can offer.
So just a couple of things to close. Unless are there other comments? So, Don, I don't question your data at all in terms of number of teardowns. But I think we're all, this subject has been discussed, the Planning Commission, the Historic Architecture Review Board, the Joint Historic Commission, and Council. I think there's a lot of folks who at least feel that there's pressure on the community towards teardowns and towards building much larger homes. And I'm not saying that's good or bad, but there's concern that it's happening without us thinking about what the repercussions are. There's two in particular. One is a feeling, for instance, on Edgeboro, that a lot of people have commented to me that it's now you've got a little ranch and this huge house next to it, and it just doesn't feel right, whether it's just doesn't feel right. And then the second thing is there have been individual homes, historic homes, not in the historic district, that the HARB has dealt with and council has dealt with, in terms of they want to subdivide the lot, they want to tear down the home, they want to do something else. So those pressures are, I think, definitely exist. Right? So what we heard tonight is that there are a lot of different tools, and some of them are quite flexible indeed, and that we can do, those tools are available to us to do what ultimately we decide is the appropriate thing to do. So that's great. That is great. The tools are there. We have you. We have potentially grants to bring on consultants. We have the wherewithal to make changes to whether it's the MPC, whether it's our zoning rules, or whether it's through changes or additions or new historic districts or all those things you mentioned, we can do what ultimately we decide to see both there. So now we got to figure out what that is. And that's going to be a difficult subject. I know we'll have additional conversations. We'll ultimately, as you suggest, sort of highlight it to the public, because as many opinions as there are in this room, there's going to be 500 more that ultimately council is going to have to wrestle with. But the feeling is there that we should be doing something. We have to start to work now on defining what that is. But it's great to hear that the tools are there, really, to do whatever we decide is needed to do. Anything else before we close? So I'll ask, I don't think we have any general members of the public here. Is this the end of the meeting where I need to offer any, if there's any public comment on this or frankly anything else, now's your time.
I would just echo what Megan is saying. Megan, for us, there will be a lot of opinions, of course, on this affordable housing, but it's a good mix of housing that look like a large house doesn't necessarily mean a bad thing. It's just what is the overall plan, and I think that's a little bit back to also what is the overall plan, comprehensive plan for the borough. It might be a good time to revisit that as well and see how this fits in, because we've got some good community feedback in that process. So it would be really interesting to see that. So that's my public citizen vote.
Thank you. All right, well, with that, we'll close the public comment section, and I'd just like to say, Megan, thank you very much.
Thank you. Very presentation.
Thank you.
We all learned a lot, and you're a good meeting leader as well, so really, really appreciate it.
Happy to be here, and I'm very happy to come back. I hope that this is the first of many conversations that we'll have, in the future, and I'm always here as a resource, so
thank you.
Please don't hesitate.
I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Oh, no, you have to do that. Any
comments? Any discussion?
Oh, please, let's not.
All in favor?
Aye.
Meeting adjourned.
Thank you again. Much appreciated.
That's aggressive for us. Yeah. I think that's not happening. And I didn't think they were going to.